New York City's mayor snubs the new archbishop. Catholic League President Bill Donahue weighs in on that and his brand new book, Christianity in the Crosshairs. And we remember actor and director Robert Duvall, who died this week. And we'll share our classic interview with the Hollywood legend. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We've got a great show for you tonight. If you'd like to send me a comment, you can always reach me on X. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. For over three decades, he's been one of the most tenacious defenders of Catholics in the public square. He's the president of the Catholic League, the largest Catholic civil rights organization in the U.S., but he's also an NYU-trained sociologist and author of 11 books, the latest of which is out in stores and online this week. Christianity in the Crosshairs, Ruling Class and Radicals Find a Common Enemy. Here to tell us all about it, please welcome back to the program, Dr. Bill Donahue. Bill, thanks for being here. I want to get to the book in a moment, but first I saw these news items and I have to get your reaction. In your beloved city of New York, Mayor Zohran Mamdani has taken the reins after being elected last year. Now, Mamdani caused quite a stir recently by skipping the installation mass of the newly appointed Archbishop Ronald Hicks of New York. Now, this is unheard of in the city, Bill. I mean, as mayors attended the past five archbishop installations in New York dating back to 1939, Bill, did the mayor manage? I know he managed to meet privately with Archbishop Hicks days after his installation. But what does the snub tell us about Mayor Mamdani when one in three New Yorkers identify as Catholics?
Well, first of all, this was the third snub. The first two didn't get as much media attention. But he was inaugurated in January. He had the members of the clergy from every religion, many Eastern religions were all there. Not one single Catholic priest was invited. Then we had the interfaith breakfast. That was the day of the installation of Archbishop Hicks. That was in the morning. He could easily have gone. You could walk right up Fifth Avenue. It was over at the public library on 42nd and Fifth Avenue. All you had to do is walk up about eight blocks and it would have been at the cathedral. He invited people from all religions to show up at the interfaith breakfast, except for Catholics. And then he didn't show up for the installation of the archbishop. So there was three of them right in a row. He sent in a message to Catholics and to Jews, by the way. The only Jews that could work for him, by the way, are Jews who are against Israel. As soon as they find out that you're a Jew who likes Israel, you're gone. So he's got it out against most Jews and Catholics. I'm sure he'll find some left-wingers and some dissident Catholics to embrace at some point. But he's got so many problems. He's only been in there now, about a month and a half? And then all the promises that he made, you know, Santa Claus giving away everything for free. Now he finds out he has no money and he can't do this and can't do that. Anybody with half a brain would have known that this is a mess. He's a train wreck, this guy.
Well, and now he's saying he's going to raid the emergency fund to make ends meet here. On Tuesday, Mamdani proposed to raise property tax rates in New York City by nearly 10%, Bill. He says he'll have no choice but to raise taxes on the middle class if Albany doesn't levy higher taxes on wealthy New Yorkers. Now, Bill, this is hardly a surprise, given that he ran as a democratic socialist, if not a full-bore communist. And if this property tax plan is pushed forward, how will it disproportionately hurt New York City's middle-class residents, many of whom are Catholic?
Well, you know, the day before he said that I'm going to raise the property taxes by about 10%, he got $1.5 billion from Albany. So you think that would be enough? No, he comes back the next day. And by the way, there's never a talk about cutting expenses except for the police department, which he hates. That's the first thing he did. He said, we're going to have to cut the number of cops and no recruits. But no, when you raise the property taxes, that's the only authority that he has, by the way. And he knew that. He just basically lied about it when he was running for office. He doesn't have any authority to raise the sales tax and things of that nature. So now he wants to raise it by 10%. Well, a lot of those people are renters. Their rent's going to go up. I thought he was supposed to do something about that. And then, of course, you have a rent freeze. And now you have but they can't fix anything in the apartment buildings because the landlords don't have the money in order to do it because they have to pay it in taxes. So he walks away from fixing things. Well, I mean, this should have been basic arithmetic. Shame on New York is that they were so willing to be seduced by this guy intellectually.
Yeah, well, I was appalled just last week looking at the lack of trash removal, the mounds of snow, Bill. I mean, it looks like an Olympic event, these poor people trying to get to the subway or get to work. When social services like that break down, that the city provides, this is a real problem in the greatest city of America and maybe the world.
The New York Times even now is showcasing this. He's killed 20 people, right? There are 20 people now who are dead. Because of his policy, they froze to death in New York City in the streets, and he let them there. He said that's their right. They have a right to make a decision. Nobody in his right mind wants to freeze to death. We take cats and dogs off the street and let human beings there to exercise their liberation. Now he's gotten such blowback from everybody. He said, well, we don't want the police to go and get rid of the homeless encampments. We're going to send in the social workers. Yeah, good luck with that. Social workers do a great job at that. The other mayors before him, they had their problems, but they did not allow the people to freeze to death.
Yeah, this is actually a good segue to Christianity in the Crosshairs, your new book. You've always had a flair for provocative titles, Bill, if I might say so. The ruling class and the radicals here in your subtitle seem like natural enemies, okay? Wall Street and Antifa don't exactly share the same zip code. You write this: the ruling class and radicals may appear to be opposites, but in some ways they are. But they share a common purpose. They want power. Whether capitalist or progressive, they want to control the average Joe. Sometimes they even work in tandem. They're good at cultivating a subdued populace, and they are masters at getting what they want. Bill, how did these two seemingly disparate groups find common ground and end up pointing at the target you identify here, Christianity, Christians?
Well, the Marxists, particularly the cultural Marxists, they've always wanted to have some degree of control over society because they were messianic. They believe that human nature is malleable. It's not fixed, which, of course, it is. They're going to transform human nature, and they're going to transform society, and they're going to take over. It's only led to bloodshed, and you can't change human nature. It's fixed. But then you see the ruling class of the wealthy ones now. They have this idea coming out of the World Economic Forum in part that we have to reset society. They don't want to engage in violence. What they want is a docile, passive population. Bill Ivey, who was an advisor to Hillary Clinton, said it best. Our goal is a compliant citizenry. Just think about that. Why would the ruling class want a compliant citizenry? Back in the 18th century, Montesquieu warned about this, even in democracies. Be careful of the rulers and what they have in mind. And in the 18th century, or the 19th century, you had Tocqueville, who called it democratic despotism. John Paul II called it soft totalitarianism. Even Pope Francis said, beware of polite persecution. Huxley and Orwell in England in the 30s and 40s warned about this. Everybody thinks you're going to wind up with Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. They killed 150 million people. There's no question about that. That's the hard totalitarianism. What we have to be careful about today, because what unites the ruling class and radicals is one thing, control. They want to control the population. They want us to be obedient, and they're going to give us, just like the Romans did, bread and circuses to keep us happy, drugs and sex and rock and roll, that kind of idea. So this is pernicious, and it eats away at people because it's ubiquitous.
Well, you write in the book, Christianity in the Crosshairs, the ruling class and the radicals share a common need. This is the quote. They can't win unless they disable the family and Christianity. Now, Bill, how are they achieving that goal? I mean, answer that first. And then my second question is, doesn't this kill their consumer base or their constituent base, diminishing their power?
Well, first of all, the reason why you have to destroy the family and religion, and particularly in this country, that means Christianity, is because the goal is to break the sense of fidelity and communion that people have. Most people, I call them the average Joe in the book, most people have their allegiance to their family and to their God. So if the goal is to have the allegiance to you, the state, the ruling class, the radicals, so they can reshape society, you've got to disable the family and religion. How do they do it with the family? Many ways. Through population control. Of course, the biggest enemy of the family is abortion. So you have abortion on demand. The idea that the children belong to the parents is regarded as an anathema to these people. Joe Biden said it many times. The International Education Association has said it. In one sense, it's an old idea going back to Plato. But what they really want is to get rid of the idea that you have a rightful heir to your children. No, the teachers and the therapists have it. We've actually seen in the last couple of years, Raymond, examples where children have been kidnapped in the United States of America from their parents who refuse to allow their kid to transition to the other opposite sex, which they can't do anyway. But they actually take them away because they say that you're a detriment to the child and the state has rights here that you don't have. So there are ways in which you can do that. And of course, with religion, they use hoaxes, they lie, they smear. They use the FBI to spy on Catholics. There are many different ways. These are soft measures. They're not sending in the troops by and large to go after people. What they're doing, they're engaging in thought control. Thought control and behavioral control. And we all can relate to what happened under COVID, right? That was thought control. Here you had all these people, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, you had Pelosi in California, people all across the country. My favorite example is Obama in Martha's Vineyard. All these people are being waited by people, all the servers, wearing masks. All the people whom they're serving, the ruling class, none of them are wearing the mask. Now, either these people are risking their lives or they know the whole thing is a scam. It's about control. You'll do and become obedient to the state and you'll listen to us. We know it's a joke. And if you engage in that, you can tell people who are male and identify them as female. That's thought control. All right. That's you can't change pronouns. No singular person is a they. We all know better. This is all insanity. Men can't get pregnant. Boys can't become girls and vice versa. But this is a way they can control you. And they use these means. Sometimes it sounds like they're being compassionate to certain people. No, you got to wake up. They're really going against the heart and soul of our society, which is the family and religion.
Bill, as a sociologist, you've been using the term ruling class. Who are you writing about there? Who are you talking about there? Are we talking about elected officials? And when you say elites want the creation of a compliant citizenry, what does that look like?
Okay, the elites are basically the ruling class of the decision makers in the major institutions in education, the media, the entertainment industry, the arts, the schools, but certainly, and in government. They basically are the decision makers in our society. They tend to be very well educated with postgraduate degrees. They are militant secularists. Very few of them believe in God. That's because they're smarter than God, obviously. They're going to take control of our society. They have a mindset and a worldview and a set of values which most people would regard as just simply very radical, extremist, and indeed hostile to Christianity. They don't represent the average person. They look down on them. They're the deplorables that Hillary Clinton talked about. Obama talked about, gripping their guns and their Bibles and the like. They're arrogant. They're sneering. They're contemptuous of the average person. And they don't think they need to consult with us. Again, because they know better. That's where the Marxists come together with the ruling class. You're talking about guys like Neville Roy Singham. Most people never heard of Neville Roy Singham. They should know about him. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who made no end to his money in America. He lives in Shanghai, and he has integral ties with the Communist Party in China. He is funding a lot of these things. He's working with Goldman Sachs, for that matter, and setting up the People's Forum. There's the problem in, not only in Wall Street, but in Silicon Valley of people working there. Where did Black Lives Matter get its money from? They got it from Apple. They got it from Amazon. They got it from the elite. Now, there are some signs, of course, with Trump there, that things are beginning to change and they're beginning to rethink some of these things, the DEI and the like. But still, anybody is crazy if they think that this is going to change overnight. The professors, it always begins in the academy. Too many of them, and I know many of them, this is a good, but many of them are dysfunctional.
Yeah. But you seem to be saying in the book, though, that there's no active conspiracy on behalf of these radicals and elites. Boardroom progressives and the street level radicals are pursuing their goals separately, one with regulatory power, the other with cultural pressure. Explain how this is being coordinated, or is it just an unhappy accident?
Well, it's not an unhappy accident. They know exactly what they're doing. When you have George Soros funding Black Lives Matter, which says that it wants to destroy the family, and when you have the World Economic Forum coming out and say that the family is the enemy, you see a conflation here. They're coming together, the radicals and the ruling class, because they both want control. They may not trust each other in the very end, and there are some signs that there are fissures there. There's too much there. I think the average American doesn't appreciate just how well they've come together, because we were brought up with the idea, oh, it's the serf against the lord, it's the working class against the capitalist. But in this book, which is actually, I'm happy to say, this is my 12th book, here tries to say, listen, we've got a real problem on our hand. Now, I'm not a doomsdayer, and there's no such thing as an iron law of history. Now, Christianity is still strong. We are resilient. This whole transgender mania is beginning to pull back. All right, we're seeing some signs that we've made progress in Europe, making progress in this country. The DEI mania is beginning to change. So I always say to people, if you listen to somebody on TV or radio who's got all the alphabets after his name, all right, I got a PhD too, so what? It's called piled higher and deeper. You know what that means? I can tell you what MS and BS believe. But you know, always trust your gut. Don't trust the guy with the alphabet. You know, I'm not saying they're all wrong, but you've got to trust your gut, because the average person knows in his heart of heart when they believe something, when they hear something that's just simply off the wall, just go right past those people. A lot of the professoriate, too many of them, they've mistaken their vocation. Instead of being in the academy, they don't even belong in the asylum.
You use the word persecution quite a bit in this book, Bill. Now, critics might say, Bill, you're being hyperbolic. Nobody's throwing Christians to the lions here or rounding people up. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's not like in Nigeria where the Muslims are just going out there and killing the Catholics. And I admit that. And I make that very clear in the book. I don't want people to misunderstand. We're not looking at the hard totalitarianism of the past. What we're looking about are much more subtle ways that Huxley talked about in Brave New World, going back to 1932, and then Orwell later in the 1940s. Huxley was a student of Orwell. And so these people are saying listen, what the ruling class wants to do is to quietly do what the Romans did, give them bread and give them circuses, give them, you know, universal basic income, keep them busy with sports. The whole idea is to get them to be peaceful and docile and obedient and leave the driving to us. And we'll shape our society. We're going to reset society because we don't like the way it is. We don't think that human nature is something that is fixed. Again, these people are militant secularists. And many of them now are supporting violence, even if they themselves are not engaged in it. That's why they don't get upset with Antifa. They're worried about Christian nationalism. They make them boogeymen to go after. No, you should be worried about Antifa, because they're the ones who kill you.
Yeah. Bill, you've been documenting anti-Catholic bias and fighting against it for three decades now at the Catholic League. Is what you're seeing now categorically different than the anti-Christian, anti-Catholicism against which you fought in the past? And how so? Is it different?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because you asked the right guy, because I've been doing it for so long. When I took over in 1993, I was preoccupied with the arts, Corpus Christi, Jesus having sex with the apostles, Brooklyn Museum of Art, and our Virgin Mary and obscene ways, the media constantly ripping at people. I'm not saying there aren't problems in the media and the arts and the entertainment industry. Certainly Disney, I fought them for many, many years. The biggest change, Raymond, is this. It's coming from the federal government and the state and the local government to a lesser extent. When you have the FBI charged under President Biden, the so-called devout Catholic, to spy on traditional Catholics, The guys in the pews, we're not talking about people who are extremists. They on Orthodox practicing Catholics, the FBI to spy on them with an idea of breaking any allegiances that they may have, because too many of them might be pro-life, et cetera. We're talking about a very different situation here. I commend President Trump for setting up a religious liberty commission. I played a role. I've given a trove of documents. I've been working with Pam Bondi's office, Harmeet Dhillon's office in particular, in giving documentation of how the federal government has been out there eating away at the rights of Catholics and indeed Christians in general. They make the crisis pregnancy centers as if they're some kind of a disaster. You know, Associated Press in their style book, they put quotes, little scare words around crisis pregnancy centers. What do you think they are? So, yeah, they're trying to pull out all the stops. And I can tell you that's my biggest fear, because no entity in society obviously has more power than government. And at the pinnacle, of course, is the federal government.
You end the book with a call to action. I'll quote you. You say the elites and radicals may have succeeded in putting Christianity in the crosshairs, but they will not succeed in destroying it. This, however, should not give us comfort. We don't need Catholics who are compliant with the dictates of the ruling class. We need Catholics who will subvert them. Bill, what does fighting back actually look like for a Catholic family today?
Well, here's one thing I'd like to leave this with the listeners. And we have a movie coming out in September, I believe. It's about how traditional Catholics and Orthodox Christians, Orthodox Jews, evangelical Protestants, perhaps some Muslims and Mormons, we're going to reach across the aisle better than what we have before. We have to. We have theological difference. That's obvious. But that can't be the end road. We've had coalitions in the past, and they've worked. But we need more of them today, because there's more of us standing firm against the people, against the dissidents within our own ranks. And every major religion does have the dissidents within their own ranks working against them. We've got to come together on this. And if we do, I don't think that the ruling class and the radicals can win. As I say, there are already some signs. I guess the one that I'm the happiest with, because I regard sex reassignment surgery for minors as the greatest expression of child abuse in this century. And the idea that the medical profession, Harvard Medical School in particular, are standing with this, supported by the Biden administration, this can't go on any longer. But it's going from the bottom up. In other words, the people, the rank and file, the average Joe person, is in anger, and we're taking over school boards, and we're letting people know we're becoming more participatory. I don't want to see everybody in the streets, but I am saying that we have to hold up a big stop sign to these people, because if it takes litigation, good. Sue the doctors, sue the hospitals, what they're doing to young boys and girls who are having a bad moment, and they take advantage of that bad patch, and they try to exploit them for money and for ideology.
Before we go, Bill, there's a spiritual dimension to this that I don't want to lose because of the moment we're in. We just started the Lenten season. You wrote a column this week that nothing is more countercultural than Lent. Bill, your thoughts on the self-destructive nature of the culture, the self-indulgent culture, how Lent is the antidote to all of that. And this really ties into the book, doesn't it?
It does. You don't miss a trick, do you, Ray? Look, there's one of the biggest problems that drives a lot of our social problems today is self-indulgence, self-absorption. You see it with the social media. You see it with the videos. You see it with sex. You see it with drugs. You see it with gambling. It's all about me, me, me. Radical individualism is what happens when you have secularism, militant secularism eclipsing Christianity. Christianity is about we. It's not about me. And we have to get back to that. Lent is about self-denial. It's not about self-indulgence. Mother Teresa could not have helped people the way she did if she didn't understand that she had to practice self-denial to sacrifice what the joys of and pleasures that most people would want. So self-denial is a virtue that is in short supply in our society. Lent celebrates it. We should not be looking at self-indulgence as the answer to liberation. Quite frankly, as Emil Durkheim and many others said, if you want to be liberated, you have to practice self-discipline, because then you can tap your resources and become the best person that you can be. It all comes down to self-restraint, self-denial, not self-indulgence, not self-absorption.
Yeah. And the balance. The church has a beautiful balance, Bill. You know, there's an economy of God and in the church that I think defies the world in many ways and defies easy categories. And look, we're seeing explosion in Ash Wednesday services, RCIA programs, Christian initiation programs, people wanting to come into the church, baptisms in Europe, in the United States. What do you think explains this? Certainly not the clarity of teaching from Rome or great examples, Bill. Why are young people seeking out faith and particularly Catholicism in this moment?
People don't like emptiness. People want to be attached. People want to have meaning. People want to know the truth. They know they've been lied to by the elites in our society, not just in education. People want something to hang on to. They want some teachings that are rich, that have been there and have stood the test of time. The Ten Commandments, for example, I mean, how many people are really against them? If you think that thou shalt not, which I know has become the three dreaded words in Western civilization, that's part of our problem. People have to understand that you just can't just say, well, we need to love each other. Love is built on sacrifice. Sacrifice is built on self-denial, not on self-indulgence. Until we get rid of these false ideas of freedom, that freedom means libertinism, which basically means a right to do whatever you want, that's a recipe right. for sexual suicide and physical suicide and psychological suicide. People want a sense of attachment. Catholicism, having stood the test of time with all its faults, if it's still around, God knows it must be doing something right that the others haven't done, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's also a recipe, I think, Bill, for societal suicide, which is, you know, what this is all about. And, you know, you reminded me, there was a reading this week, might have been today, and it was Moses saying, look, I give you life and I give you death. The choice is yours. You can either follow these commandments or you can go your own way. And that's really still the choice we all face. And it's really the heart of your book. It's life and death. Take your pick. Fire and water. Go ahead. Make your choice. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah. We got to get rid of this idea that everything is a social construct, that there is such a thing as truth. Not everything is a social construct. There is something called nature. You have XX, you have XY. You can believe you're a giraffe. That's fine. The postmodernist, no such thing as truth. Hitler said the same thing. It's all madness. Mm. We need to build more asylums.
Mm. Bill Donahue, the new book, Christianity in the Crosshairs, is available at bookstores everywhere and online, including the EWTN Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com. Bill Donahue, we'll check in with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And over on the Arroyo Grande podcast this week, I sat down with legendary singer-songwriter Don McLean to talk about his musical journey, including his iconic song, American Pie, the cultural significance of his work. And really, he talks about his faith, personal loss, and how the music is really never dying. He's still out on the road. Don, you're 80 years old, and you're still on tour. Why still go out there and perform? Haven't you already proven yourself? My goodness.
Oh, I'm not interested in proving myself at all. I'm satisfied with what I did with my life, and I could sit back and look at, you know, all kinds of things and say, oh, well, you did it. I don't want to do that. I want to give something to people. Mm. You know, I want to give something to people. I want to have moments where I express my ideas or sing a song that some little boy or girl never heard before and thinks beautiful, and they want to go home and maybe write a song like that, or they like that idea or whatever. That's what I want to do, and that's what I've always wanted to do with my life. You know, I never had to be a stadium guy where I was always playing these great places and making, you know, $1 million a night. I wouldn't mind doing that, of course, because I like money. But I do all levels of things. I play all kinds of places, and I'm a grassroots guy, really. If you will, more so, where, you know, I can get my ideas across and do an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes, really, when we sing, and a lot of different songs. And I'll never know what I'll say, but the audience seems to like it. And as I say, there's always that little boy or girl in there who might want to take up the guitar.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Don McLean is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande show. It's free. And of course, be on the lookout for Friday's installment of the Prayerful Posse. We're going to dive into the controversial cause for sainthood that has been approved and a papal mass featuring altar girls. Never a dull moment. Go to Arroyo Grande show wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube. This week, we lost a true Hollywood legend and a good soul. Robert Duvall passed away on February 15th at his home in Middleburg, Virginia. He was 95. Since his breakout role as Boo Radley in the 1962 classic To Kill a Mockingbird, he inhabited an array of unforgettable characters. The original Frank Burns in MASH, of course, Tom Hagen in The Godfather, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore in Apocalypse Now.
You want to wait here for 6 hours?
And his Oscar-winning turn as Max Sledge in 1983's Tender Mercies. He was also nominated for an Emmy for his work as the wise old Texas Ranger Gus McCrae in Lonesome Dove, a role he called American Shakespeare. In the late 1990s, he wrote and directed and produced and starred in a very personal film, I think one of his finest, The Apostle. It was filled with themes of forgiveness and redemption and faith that were really characteristic of so much of his best work. I sat down with him at his home a number of years ago, and we talked about his then-latest film, Get Low, another film rooted in faith, his process as an actor, and that seamlessly endless list of iconic roles. Here's Robert Duvall.
And I want to be there.
You will be, I guarantee you.
I want to be there now.
You want to be at your funeral party alive?
Yes, sir.
But you can't have a funeral if you're not, you know, deceased.
Hold on now. It's a detail. We can look at it.
Pretty big detail.
You want to have a funeral party while you're alive so you can go?
Yes or no?
Yes. Buddy, get some paper. We need to make a list of who Mr. Bush wants to invite.
Well, sit down there. I want everybody to come who's got a story to tell about me.
Let's talk for a moment about this film and this character. Felix Bush strikes me as a lot like Boo Radley.
No, not at all.
Well,
not at all.
But
everybody says
hermits.
That. Not even close.
Okay. What's the
to
difference?
To me, not even close. The difference being this guy could have been a lawyer, a teacher. He could have been a world traveler. He could have been, you know, whatever. He could have been many things. But he chose to be a recluse. But I mean, but
he's a self-exiled recluse.
Yeah, self. Uh-huh. Boo Radley was a little off. You know.
But there is a tenderness beneath the expectation that the world has of these people that I think is in common, that is much more beneath the surface than the world sees.
Yeah, exactly.
In both of these men.
Well, and also, this is like a Horton Foote movie, and he didn't live long enough to see it. I wanted him to see it, but he died right before we started it.
Yeah.
No, during the scene I'm giving the speech.
In front of everybody at the end.
The first day when I did it for them, my wife's off camera. She gets a message that Horton Foote just passed away during the death scene.
Wow.
She got goose pimples. It was like it was full circle for To Kill a Mockingbird, all the things I did with Horton till that point. Dealing with death, he was like he was there.
You have such a long relationship with him.
Yeah.
And every project, I would argue, the ones that you've poured your heart and soul in and have been directly involved in, are Horton Foote-esque in the sense that...
This was very much that way.
You have people who the world often forgets or doesn't want to think about, and yet they're the depth of their lives, the eternal realities that they deal with every day in small ways,
right,
is apparent.
Exactly.
Do you sense that? Do you have a sense of that? That you're drawn to that material?
Yeah, I'm drawn to many things. I played Stalin.
Yeah, he wasn't exactly a tender character.
I played Adolf Eichmann. Yeah. But so I played different parts in military guys, but the certain parts do have strain of humanity throughout that's... very appealing as a performer, and very appealing to a certain portion of the public.
Would you say that you're drawn to Southern stories more than others?
Could be. I mean, I was attached to this, and then it got off track, and they brought Charlie Mitchell in from Alabama to put those touches that made it like a Southern tale. It was wonderful.
There's a redemptive sensibility in this movie, and in all the best parts that you've really, I think, become renowned for, if you permit me to say. Do you, as an actor, are you drawn to characters that have a sense of redemption in them and tales that are redemptive?
It happens to be that, but I don't think about it consciously or intellectually. It's just something I...
But you're drawn to it nonetheless.
Yeah, well, you know, mm-hmm. yeah. interesting characters, absolutely. I mean, as long as there's drama and contradictions, and they're not all one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all one thing.
Speaking of commas, drama and contradictions, one of my favorite films, I think my wife and I saw it four times, was The Apostle.
Yeah, exactly.
And this you wrote, you directed, you starred in.
Right. I financed it.
You financed, you paid the bill.
Exactly.
And therein, I mean, there are a handful of films that I think I could name and I dare anybody else to name that have the sense of contradiction and truth to a character, yet reveal that redemption beneath. The Apostle is littered with that, Robert.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, talk to us about the opening scene of The Apostle.
The opening scene came from, I knew a woman whose mother was a Pentecostal preacher, and she was pretty, what she did was she would get premonitions about car wrecks and highway wrecks and would literally go down and get in the scene and preach the stoppage of blood, that quote from the Old Testament. So that's exactly, that's where I got that whole thing from.
Now listen to me now. There are angels, even in this automobile at this precise moment. He has sent his angels here to watch over you. Now, do you accept him here today?
Yeah.
Thank you,
hey,
Jesus.
Hey, mister.
Thank you,
you
Jesus.
You have to get out of there. You can't be in there. You hear me?
Yeah. Now, when that ambulance gets you in there on your way, you're going to fly down the highway. Lord's going to have a whole flock of his angels lead you on that
Come on,
highway.
Get out.
He's going to go all the way with you. You've taken the Lord today, he's going to go all the way with you, because you both are his champions here today. Praise God.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Don't have to thank me, son. Thank our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. You're in his hands. Bless you both. Wherever two or more gathered in my name, there would I be also.
Mister?
Glory.
I'm sorry about this, but you've got to go back to your car. You
yes,
can't
sir.
Be out here.
Yes,
you're not allowed here.
I understand that.
I guess you think you accomplished something in there, huh?
I know I did.
What?
All I know is I did not put my head through that window in vain.
Well, how would you know that?
Well, I'm going to tell you. I'd rather die today and go to heaven than live to be 100 and go to hell.
So a lot, that whole script was from stories, true stories that happened within that community.
But you traveled around. You were doing documentaries in the South, in Appalachian Territory. I mean, you almost organically stew this material
absolutely,
for a long time.
Absolutely, because I love the black preachers.
Oh, yeah, nothing like them.
Oh, they're one that likes the surrogate father figure to the people of their community.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I did research all over America, Los Angeles, the South, Texas, many, many times.
One of the things I love about that opening scene, because you see he rushes into a car wreck, he prays over this couple,
right.
And you see what appears to be a miracle happening
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Why did you put that in? Because a lot of people, even now, seeing that film, say, oh, this guy's just a phony. He's coasting on his ability
no,
to talk.
No, he's not a phony.
But that kind of contradicts
no,
that.
I mean, everything's percentages. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these television preachers that start out very sincere, they go adrift.
They drift.
But there's a percentages of what's still spiritually valid and what offsets that. The guy's not a phony.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you this, and I will challenge these people. Mm-hmm. He's less of a phony than King David that wrote the Psalms that we worship and adhere to, who sent a man off to die so he could have the wife.
Mm-hmm.
My guy didn't do that. He killed the guy out of like out of an impulse, really.
Mm-hmm.
So... He's not a phony, really.
No. He struggled, and you see him struggling with that call on his life.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the end, in the prison,
yeah, exactly.
He's still preaching to these
exactly.
guys, finding redemption and sharing it with others.
Exactly.
Do you sense that in yourself, that struggle with faith?
Everybody has it. Everybody has it. Yeah, everybody has it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at the body of your work, the whole corpus, there is a humanity, an understanding, but beneath it is this... Maybe preoccupation is too strong a word, but a sense of the eternal, and that
right.
even in our mundane lives, the eternal is always here.
One of my thrusts is that we all have our journey from the cradle to the grave. And we try to do what we can do without stepping on too many toes. Mm. And my only disagreement I may have with some of these religious people, you know, mm-hmm. about being saved. You will not go to heaven.
Once saved, always saved.
Yeah. To me, the day of judgment is not now. It's on the other side of the grave. And how can a human preacher say you're either going to go to heaven or you're not going to go to heaven? Mm-hmm. It's on the other side of the grave, the day of judgment.
It's a work in progress until
that gavel comes down.
What's on your mind, sir?
Yeah. About time for me to get low.
To get what?
Down to business.
Yeah.
I need a funeral.
For whom?
Me.
For you. You want to buy a funeral for you?
Am I not talking right?
I'm sorry, sir. Are you sick?
Everybody dies.
All right. I see. Well, sir, the church can help you get your affairs in order and arrange a service for you.
Well, what would you say?
About what?
Me.
Eulogy. Well, I don't know. What do you want me to say?
Say what you say right now to my face.
Well, Mr. Bush, I don't know much about you. I've heard stories, but...
What stories?
Just stories, you know. People talk.
What kind of story? Second one.
Well, sir, my mother used to say that gossip is the devil's radio. Uh-huh. What matters is that when you come to the end of your life, that you're ready for the next one. Now, have you made peace with God, sir?
I paid.
Mr. Bush, you can't buy forgiveness. It's free, but you do have to ask for it.
One of the things I loved about Get Low, first of all, tell me about that title, Get Low. What's your read on that?
Well, if you ask the director and everybody involved with this, they'll have a different answer. To me, to get as specific as I can, I think get low is to get down. Mm-hmm. Get down for Jesus. Mm-hmm. Get down. You're still above the ground, but you get low and find your sense of humility or whatever to get down to basics, down to mm-hmm. spiritual business.
And this character you play, Felix Bush, he carries this burden with him.
Yes.
I mean, he exiles himself to the woods. He carries this secret that we don't really learn until much later. How did you prepare for this role? I mean, this man's a loner, living alone in the woods. Did you cordon yourself off from friends and family?
We vacation at least once a year, usually in Argentina, where Luciana's people are from northern Argentina. And I remember that long speech and a lot of those things. I just sat facing the South American Andes, the mountains, and just contemplated and worked on it. I think working for a sense of solitude, to find that sense of solitude.
You fill these moments with this unspoken truth that isn't in the script. Nothing funny is happening in the background. It's just there.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for that?
You just do that. You think of this, think of the character. And actually, one of the money guys from Germany, when it was all over, a German, hit it on the head that none of us had thought of. He said, this movie is a love story.
Oh.
It's a love story. Going back in time to the woman, everything.
Yeah, it all comes back. It comes full circle.
Absolutely.
And this notion that we have to make amends before we go. We have to confess. We have to somehow deal with the stuff of life and the mistakes we make in life,
Absolutely. That's what he's done for many years, and he wants to... He finds he has an illness, and before he really goes, he sets up and has his own funeral, a make-believe funeral, before he has the real one, where he won't be there.
Yeah.
And this is based on a real guy, but fictionalized.
Mm. Now, I'm not a smart man or a wise one. I don't know what kind of man I am. I was always restless. Thought I'd see the world, but I didn't go nowhere on purpose because I did something I was ashamed of, something I could never fix. Y'all probably think you know what you do, what you wouldn't, and I wish you good luck with that, I really do.
When I told Charlie what I'd done, he told me to confess to God, the law, and somebody else, so as I could get forgiveness. But I didn't want forgiveness. No. I needed to hold on to what I did, to be sick from it every day of my life, so that I never told nobody else. You see? Nobody.
Now, you, of course, won an Academy Award for Tender Mercies. Yeah. Another character. You find him flat, drunk, laid out at the beginning of that movie. Right. And he, too, struggles with faith, with redemption, with relationships, and finds his way out of that pit. That journey.
And a help from a good woman.
Right, yeah. And a little boy.
Yeah, exactly.
And a song that you wrote, a couple of songs. A
few background songs, not the main ones. Yeah,
but they were
pretty good. But he had a support system. When we did Crazy Heart, the part with Jeff Bridges, he didn't have a good support system. My character in the Horton Foote play had a support system that helped him, which was very good.
What was it about Horton Foote's writing and work that so attracted you? I know you were friends for many, many years.
Well, I did a play of his way back about a guy at the Neighborhood Playhouse under Sandy Meisner, where I played a drunk. And it came in, and it worked. Something emotional really worked for me, that they gave me this part. And Horton Foote came one night with his wife and Kim Stanley, and Bob Mulligan, who directed eventually, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
And 2 years later, when they were going to cast that movie, Lillian Foote said to Horton, his wife said, "Well, what about that young man we saw in your play at the Neighborhood Playhouse? He'd be very good for Boo Radley."
And that's how you got the role.
Yeah, I want to thank Horton and his wife for that.
What a moment. Since you brought Sandy Meisner up, let's talk about him for a moment.
Right.
Sandy Meisner was a member of the group theater.
Right.
He was a renowned acting teacher in New York whom you studied with. Tell me about that technique. Meisner had a very bare-bones technique in many ways.
Very bare-boned. I mean, he once told me he was easier to please than Lee Strasberg at the studio, where everything was so critical. These guys were pretty critical, so you had to have arrive at a certain sense of relaxation to work under their auspices. Mm-hmm. But Sandy, what I took from him mostly, I guess, was the way of, improvising, just talking and listening, the way we're doing now.
That repetition exercise.
Yeah, that came after I was there, but that's wonderful.
Really?
But this, you know that exercise.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you work with.
You worked with?
You worked with Sandy. Yeah, no,
you worked with?
No, it wasn't there when I was there.
You worked with?
What?
What?
I know that exercise, but I never, when I was there,
worked with.
It didn't work. Yeah, you work. Yeah.
You worked with?
Yeah, you work with.
You?
You? Me?
You?
What were you looking at?
We?
Yeah, right.
That's the exercise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it goes back and forth.
It's a form of improvisation that takes you off of the text.
You throw the text away.
Yeah, right.
Do you use that kind of improvisation?
Sometimes
when
I direct. Uh-huh. When I directed the Gypsy film, I use that and others. But, it's like, not so much, but, like somebody says, the more the actor's studio, the other method, they come on stage with a big bag of yesterday.
Right.
Sandy was more in the moment.
Yeah, Strasberg made you go into this memory thing of your past, and you'd bring that up.
Right.
I studied with Stella Adler, who was, had her own fixations. But it was character work.
Exactly.
And you do an enormous amount of character work.
It actually has to come back to you.
Uh-huh.
Shifted a certain way. And that's what Sandy says, a way of doing it.
Uh-huh.
Rather, people say, do you become the character? Well, that can be a danger. You can be in your head the character and emotionally nothing's happening.
Mm.
So it's like, it has to, I call it from ink to behavior when you get a part, from ink to behavior.
Uh-huh.
To find that behavior that fulfills what the character calls.
And how do you do that? Do you go, when you get a role of the Lonesome Dove, when you're playing Gus McCrae, that role lands in your lap. What do you do? What's the first thing you do?
You read the script and find out it's such a good script, you're going to let it take you along. McMurtry still said we should have switched parts, and I totally disagree with him.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
And what I did was something led me, strangely, out to West Texas, and I bumped into old Sammy Ball, the quarterback for the Washington Redskins.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know who I was. We talked for like 2 hours because the person I was with had played football under him with the Houston Oilers, Larry Elkins. And all those gestures I got in the part were from Sammy Ball.
Mm-hmm. One of your neighbors here whom you worked on a project with, and you cultivate these projects, Broken Trail.
Right.
a fellow here who owns an adjoining farm, had written his, or wanted, told you a story, and you encouraged him to write the script.
Yes.
He did. It became an AMC movie, beautiful movie.
AMC won't even pick up our phone anyway. Well, we put them on the map.
Well, that's right. You were the first film that AMC did. They should be ringing your phone.
I don't know what their deal is now. But
I love that story in that you cultivated this. This story attracted you. It was from the earth. It was from a man who wasn't a professional writer.
No, but he had a great sense of a great ear for dialogue. It was based on the Haythorne family, the Haythorne Land and Cattle Company of Arthur, Nebraska, who actually had a horse drive in the 20s from the west to east. And I think if you really look at it, it may be better directed, I mean, better realized in some respects than even Lonesome Dove. It was very well done.
Beautifully acted.
I think the casting was even better.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I love about that is your neighbor who worked on that screenplay, Broken Trail, he said, Bob Duvall collects characters.
Yeah, I've been accused of that in the past. I would like to have a character party someday. But I love to collect characters. I do, because you know, you learn from them in life. That's your guide. Mm-hmm. That becomes your guide, like Sammy Ball was to a point when I did Lonesome Dove. But the script was so good that Bill Whitliff did from the novel that it just led you.
Yeah.
Who was such a wonderful character on the written page, even Augustus McCrae.
You, I know, are a huge fan of an actor you worked with famously in The Godfather, Marlon Brando.
Yeah. What time does my daughter leave with the bridegroom?
Well, in a few minutes, right after they cut the cake. Now, your new son-in-law, we'll give him something important.
Never. Give him a living, but never discuss the family business with him. What else?
Virgil Salazzo called. Now we're going to have to give him a day sometime next week.
We'll discuss him when you come back from California.
When am I going to California?
I want you to go tonight. I want you to talk to this movie, Big Shot, and settle this business for Johnny. Now, if there's nothing else, I'd like to go to my daughter's wedding.
What was it about Brando? I only met him once. You had a little more familiarity with him. Tell me about Brando, what it was like working with him and what you learned from him.
Well, what I learned was that when I did a movie, it wasn't a very good movie. It was a Horton Foote script initially called The Chase. I learned from him that when he was having coffee, he'd have coffee, get up, do the scene, action, cut, go back to coffee. Mm-hmm. And it was all really the same. Huh. There was a sameness between when he was off camera and on camera.
A naturalness.
Yeah, something that's, people say, oh, well, he plays himself. Try it, not easy. Uh-huh. It's not easy. Uh-huh. And I learned that from him.
But he took great risks, and you do too. These character choices. You look different from film to film, but it's an internal. It's not
It's got to be,
makeup.
And I think that he finally, not that he sold out, he got tired. He was spoiled at a young age. Mm-hmm. And I always said to him, you should play Othello on stage. No. He said, you know, it's boring. He didn't like it. And I can understand doing a play 8 times a week. And he became maybe jaded. He didn't like his children to visit him on the set. He didn't think it's a noble profession, which I think it can be. Mm-hmm. You benefit people by doing certain parts.
Why do you do this now? You don't have to do this anymore.
No, I like it. I love it. I still like it. You know, people offer me parts. I mean, I haven't wiped the drool yet, you know, so why not?
Keep going.
And there's some really good parts coming my way now, if they can get the money for them.
Right. I hear you're working on La Mancha.
Yeah,
they want you to play La Mancha?
Yeah, Man from Don Quixote, which I understand recently when I was in Texas that Larry McMurtry based some of his concepts of Lonesome Dove on Don Quixote.
Ah.
Somebody told me that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What else do you have in the hopper?
Well, I'm going to do a movie called 7 Days from Utopia about golf. It's kind of a nice, feel-good, kind of a, not a Christian movie, but a nice movie, and about golf and about, you know, relationships. And then we're trying to get the Hatfields and McCoys off the ground. Eric Roth has written a brilliant script.
I saw that.
Oh, what a script.
I want to return to Get Low before we go. What do you want people to take away from this film?
People always ask me that, and I never know what to say. They take away whatever they get from it, you know, a certain sense of humanity, because I don't know about message movies, but a certain sense of humanity. And like that German soccer player said, it is a love story. And none of us connected with that film had ever thought of that. It is a love story going back in time, you know, that propelled this this ill-fated love story that propelled this man to live this hermetic life of his.
No, it's a beautiful film. It's one of those
films. It's a lovely film. It really is.
It marks you. You know, you carry
it with you. It's my wife's favorite film since The Apostle.
Final question. What do you want your lasting legacy to be?
Maybe my journey from the cradle to the grave. I hope I did certain positive things without stepping on too many toes.
Mm, well, you've certainly done it here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
May Robert Duvall, who did manage to step on very few toes, I might add, rest in peace. What a gentleman. What an actor. He'll be missed, and we pray for the repose of his soul. That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.